Hello and welcome to Required Reading, the podcast that revisits the most impactful books from our childhood. And I'm realizing this will be the first episode of 2026, so Happy New Year! My name is Erin Bowles. I'm a writer, actor, and comedian, and our guest today is Liz Wiest. Liz is a bi-coastal Philadelphia and New York-based film and television creative. You can find her writing about all things cinema for Movie John, all things comedy for Reductress, and peruse her IMDb for a glimpse into her production life. Welcome!
Thank you so much for having me, Erin. Very excited.
I am so excited to talk about this book. From 2007 by Rachelle Mead, Vampire Academy.
Yes.
I don't...
Also not, because I feel like so many people haven't heard of it.
It, like, comes out in 2007. We are... I did just a tiny, tiny smidge of research on, like, vampire trends. And This seems like in the midst of it, you know, year before the Twilight movie comes out. But I don't think I had ever heard of it.
Most people haven't, which, like, you know, revisiting this book for the first time after 12 years is probably for the best. honestly, like, and I do feel like, please forgive my pun, I do feel like Twilight really eclipsed it, but it all comes down to preferences, right? Like, do you prefer problematic age gap, really kind of bastardized Russian culture, or do you prefer Mormon propaganda? And you know what? Everybody's different.
That's so right. Like you said, this is a lot about Russian, Balkan, sort of Slavic mythology. Rachelle Mead actually studied folklore and religion in college, and that's where she said, you know, I was very separate from the vampire trend. I didn't do it because Twilight did it. The ideas just sort of came to her from that academic perspective. She has 3 degrees, including a Master of Comparative Religion and a Master of Teaching. So she was an 8th grade teacher in English and Social Studies until her first she sold her first novel, which is Succubus Blues, which I think is an adult novel.
It gives that.
Yeah, it gives that. Have you read it? Have you read the whole series?
You know,
or this series?
I did kind of, I fell off Vampire Academy about halfway through. They're all things considered kind of long books, especially for the kind of books that they are. Also, too, like, you know, Twilight did have a chokehold on me, like every other, you know, preteen girl at that time. Also, you know, I was Grace on Top of the movie came out at the same time. You know, I will say I do feel like all of that makes sense about Rachelle Mead. It's slightly concerning that she was a teacher, and that is to some degree the primary focal point with, like, the romance. That does concern me slightly, but that definitely makes sense just with all the different feeder themes in there. I do believe her. I'm going to choose to give, like, I think plausible deniability. She definitely was not influenced by Twilight. I really don't think so.
Yeah, there's this, I mean, obviously the plot is Academy for Vampires. What could go wrong there? But we follow, it's first person narrated by Rose, who is a dampier. All of these very Slavic words.
Well, I'm confused because, so I read the book in its heyday when it came out, kind of slightly later. And then I revisited it as an audiobook. And in the, I thought, which I did think, I'm going to be honest, I think the audiobook was very poorly produced. But they kept saying dampire. And I'm like, that can't be right. Ooh. That just simply can't be right. Like, I think I'm choosing to believe it's dampier because that just sounds more Balkan, more Slavic, and also is just not as corny.
Within this, there's sort of 3 genres of people, which is the Morai or Moroi, who are normal vampires, like, and then dampiers are half vampire, half human, and they are guardians. They are assigned, like, one-to-one. The school is for teaching vampires and for teaching guardians. So the book follows Rose and her best friend Lissa, who is a Morai, and then there are sort of the antagonists, which are the Strigoi, who are like our common understanding of vampires. They kill humans. They don't just feed off of them. They lose their access to magic. And the book starts with Lissa and Rose have run away from the Vampire Academy. They've been on the run for 2 years. It's very in media res. And they are finally caught by the school people and brought home. And oh, this is where it gets really in the weeds. Lyssa is part of one of the special royal families, so she needs an on-site guardian who's Dimitri, and then he starts training Rose and they develop a relationship, which he very much at the end says, you know, I'm too old for you. You need to figure things out and who you want to be. And
Until the
actually,
sequel, of course.
until the sequel, yes. Well, she is 17, so they're like, just wait. They don't say this, but as a reader, you're like, yeah, just give it a couple months and then we'll really get what we want.
Exactly. And they still give you too much in the.
Yeah, there's a very, very hot and heavy scene at the end with complicated questions of consent that they do very tidily in a single line of dialogue tie up at the end. That's like, well, there's a spell, but it couldn't have worked unless you both wanted it already.
Yeah, they're very diplomatic about how they handle that. It becomes it's almost like a buzzer beater in a way with how they're able to get away with that. And
Exactly.
later on, it gets less it gets increasingly uncomfortable
Oh,
later on
yeah.
in the series. But it's all the relationships in question are very interesting. Like, you know, you have the relationship with the two best friends, which is written in such a, I mean, all of the relationships are written with such a Y2K lens that it's like pick me galore, just very, very much just all of that. Which is, it's funny because it's like I feel like she's so badly, like there was a part of her that wanted to write, there was a part of her that wanted to do like the Princess Diaries, the click thing, and she like I just you just feel that wanting to come out the whole time and it just can't in some ways, but yeah.
It's all first person. It's not necessarily a diary version, but what I did appreciate is that amidst all this very complicated lore, Mead didn't try to have it come out kind of naturally. It wasn't like, well, Lyssa, you know that in our society, X, Y, and Z, she really is like, here's how it works. There is no sort of like you that she is telling the story to, but there are very clean breaks of like, let's figure this out, let's get it stated, and then move on. And I appreciated that kind of like frankness within the narrative.
100%, because that's among many, many other factors why I think the movie just did not fell flat. And then they actually did a Peacock series of it in
Yeah.
2022. And I also think that, you know, that's part of why, because it's just like, especially to have a movie, it's just so exposition heavy. It's so just, here's this relatively complex like world with all this lore and all these relationships that you kind of can't think too hard about some of them. Yeah, so I think that's definitely something that really works on the page and less on the screen, because it's a lot of telling, not showing. But in this case, I would kind of say it works.
I think so, yeah. Rose is an interesting character, especially in the pop culture sphere of Bella Swans.
Yes.
She, like you were saying, is sort of a pick me to a degree, but she is sort of very forthright. One thing that I loved about this character is that she likes to flirt. There's really like the other characters around her, there's a lot of slut shaming, but there is like from Mead, there's nothing wrong, I think, with wanting to flirt and enjoying being a little lustful. And I like that, especially for
Yeah.
2007. Yeah.
Especially for 2007, it's especially apt for the vampire genre, right? Which is also it's the anti-Twilight in that way. Like Twilight took the vampire genre, which is, you know, vampires are symbolic and encapsulate everything that is taboo, everything that's what people are afraid of in a sense. And I do think, you know, me kind of took a page from Dracula almost, or Carmilla in that sense of, it's like Rose embodies, even though she's like, she embodies it in the sense that like she is flirty, she is lustful, she is all those things, she is all those things that a girl, especially her age, you know, quote unquote, shouldn't be, and things that vampires are and do embody. But also she is a virgin, and she is, you can tell it, like the facade of her that is very promiscuous, it is very much a facade that as a reader it's very obvious to you, but it's not obvious to the characters in the book. And so it's like she has this interesting, like she walks both lines, and she's not a full vampire, she's not all of those things, but she walks the line of both, which is a kind of a unique angle to take on that specific genre, I think.
Yeah, she's a very, very interesting character. I think the thing about being a virgin is within the first handful of pages, it is very quickly established. But I'm realizing in talking about it, I don't think I've asked, like, what is your story with this book? You know, how did it first come into your life? What was your relationship to it? Sort of the before image, before coming to this.
Sure. Well, I was very into all the spooky books. I've read Dracula 3 times. I have I'm looking at my nightstand right now, and it goes Elvira's memoir, Her Body at Other Parties, Haunting in Venice, Carmilla, Interview with the Vampire. Clearly I haven't changed that much. I've gone from like a crunchy, spooky teen to hopefully a polished goth adult. But I was very into the vampire genre. Again, like that's very much, I think, something the next generation, it's gonna be the big, like, you just had to be there. You had to be there for the vampire craze of the early aughts. And I was in it. I had to, so I was raised very, very strictly Catholic, which I think is part of why this specific series spoke to me. 'Cause I mean, you have the academy element, which in the way it's structured feels very Catholic school vibe. It's like my the physical building of my high school looked like Hogwarts. So it's like for me, that like teenage me, that was everything. And so it's like my favorite genre in this world that I know. And also, again, like all big kicker with the Vampire Academy series, all of them are canonically Catholic. Which, like, you know, anybody who's raised in Roman Catholicism knows, like, they are. The goth world is just Catholicism's weird cousin, really, but they share the
Absolutely.
same genus, really. So that at the time it was just everything. I'm like, oh, like I'm part of this world. Like the jump into that world wasn't as far as a jump in the imaginary sense for me as it was with Twilight. And like, don't get me wrong, like I had to hide my copy of Twilight underneath my pillow from my mom, like when I was reading, and she took it from me for a while. I had to fight to get it back. So, but this world for me immediately, more so even than Twilight, just immediately captured my heart. I like the strong female protagonist, of course. Like everybody wants to see themselves in Rose. And I saw myself in her more than I ever saw myself in Bella. No shade to Bella, of course. But like Bella's, I mean, I don't actually, maybe a little bit of shade. She's kind of a nothing burger, a little bit. And that is like kind of the, like Rose is the anti-Bella. And that I was like, oh, this is like Twilight, but like it's a little bit edge, a little bit of like, ooh, a little bit of seasoning on there. Ironically, how I found Vampire Academy was because of my job that I had in high school. A friend of mine was talking to me about it. She was so obsessed with it, whatever. She was a 17-year-old who was in a Rose and Dimitri style relationship. So now that I look back, I'm like, oh,
In so many of the novels that I've looked at on this podcast that have sort of a sci-fi or fantasy element, the ones that succeed are the ones that really balance the heightened fantasy and the very, very mundane and things that are, like you were saying, are accessible. And so there is, life and death stuff. We're looking at how Lyssa fits into this extremely complex societal structure and is dealing with all sorts of negative forces. And there's also a lot of rumors and slut shaming and am I going to see my best friend before lunch? And do we have classes together afterwards? And,
They're passing notes. I'm like, these characters can use magic, but they're still, these characters have a bond, mind you. They have a psychic bond and they're still passing notes in class. And I'm like, they're girls, really.
we must address the psychic bond
Yes.
because
You can't not.
you can't not. So, Lyssa and Rose have a psychic bond that ends up being like paralleled to some ancient stories. And again, like the ancient stories that we're looking at are saints.
Yes,
That
they're
again, it's.
supposed to be canonically Roman Catholic saints who believe in the biblical version of that God, that entity, which is hilarious. They go to church on Sundays. They go to like mandatory church on Sundays. They go to mass,
They
which is
go
so
to
funny.
mass.
They go to mass. They are at mass. They're at the Combination Academy, Vampire Academy at mass, Roman Catholic.
Exactly.
It's so silly. Yeah, the bond is. It's so funny because especially like when you look at the older, like we'll say Carmilla for example, which is it might, I have to fact check myself, but it's like might be the first vampire novel. I think it does predate Dracula, and you know it's a female vampire. Carmilla was the prototype for the Morticia Adams and the Elviras and the all of that came from her. And Mark of the Vampire, I believe it's the Lon Chaney film, that one I believe also took from her as well. But she, preys on and like goes after females and women as well. And like they develop like a sort of bond. And it's written in such, especially for the time, like, such a suggestive, very erotic way, in a way that Vampire Academy is just simply not. These are two aggressively heterosexual women that just kind of are like
Really?
stuck in each other's heads, really. Like it almost sounds like when I read about like this psychic bond, I'm like, oh, like on paper, it's like it's so romantic and like girls girl in a way, like, oh, I have a bond with my best friend. Like, they're like annoyed about it. Like they like in a way, like it's like they make it sound annoying. It's like they can't necessarily control it. Like she's in her head all the time. Like I read this book and I'm like, oh, this would annoy me. This sounds like a dramatic inconvenience.
I read it as so gay. I read it as like girls can kiss.
But these ones won't.
No, these ones simply won't.
They won't. As
But
much as you want them to, doesn't matter. They still won't. Like,
there is like, and we were introduced by a friend of the pod, Georgia Shank, who was just on actually doing the click fairly recently.
love the click. Like, yeah, love it.
But
Love.
Georgia and I have talked at length about the intensity and obsession of female friendships, especially in high school, and they're fascinating to me. And they're particularly fascinating to me because I didn't realize I was queer until my senior year of high school. And I think there is not always, but often a little bit of queerness in it. It's these
Oh,
relationships,
100%.
yeah, that don't neatly fall into just platonic and just friendships. And I think what's interesting about this is this psychic bond only goes one way. Rose can tell what Lyssa is feeling. Sometimes she is, first person within Lyssa's head, but it doesn't go the other way. And that I think like there are these repeated moments of Rose seeing Lyssa have a variety of kinds of bonds, friendships, romance, even Lyssa feeds on some humans, and then there's complex lore there. But in all of those instances, Rose is jealous when people come closer to Lyssa, even though they have like the deepest, literal psychic bond. And that felt so relatable to me. There were so many instances where I felt my best friend leaning towards other people, and that was such a distinct and unique and painful experience that I thought was so cool to see here.
I couldn't agree more, and that's definitely something that resonated with me at the time that I didn't fully understand until much later in life on account of the whole being raised Catholic thing. And it's funny because especially like I was obsessed with I really ran the gamut of vampire books. And generally speaking, when you have that trope that's present in vampire novels, even the one-way bond, it's generally like well, first of all, it's already flipped here. Generally, it's the vampire who can tap into the lesser, usually a human, but in this case, like human substitute for a human character. It's flipped. So the person with the lesser amount of power has the access to the bond in this one, which is something that I mean, I can't think of anything actually that comes close to that. But I think it's also why I didn't realize that this book in particular, I'm going to point to this book specifically and say this is probably one of the reasons I didn't know I was queer until later, is because when you look at the bond that Rose and Lyssa have, generally, again, back to when this trope exists in vampire novels, it's to get some sort of control, manipulation, sexual usually, or blood from, which, tomato tomato, from a person. The bond is used in a dark and manipulative and often evil way. And like you said, it's a blurs the lines of consent, but like here it's used in a really beautiful way that's purely for protection and love, and which is very beautiful. It's like it's queer coded romance, not even just like queer coded erotica, like, which I mean, they kind of toe on that in the sense that it's like, oh, she feeds off of her, but like fully, like you don't really get the intensity, like the scenes where Lyssa's feeding off Rose, it feels clinical almost, even though she describes what basically sounds like climaxing when she's coming to it. It feels clinical. It doesn't feel like there's anything more than deep friendship there, but where I feel like the lines get blurred is just in the way that she talks about Lyssa and how Lyssa is her everything. I think part of why you're able to buy that they're not in love with each other is by taking something that's what's more taboo than being in a queer relationship. Oh, being with somebody much older. So it's like, okay, look over here. Like, here's the red herring relationship in a way. Like, I almost feel like that's a So really effective diversion, because
Yeah,
none
I
of the
hadn't
other
thought of that at
male
all.
characters are really, you wouldn't buy it. You wouldn't buy it. It's like Ariana Grande and SpongeBob. You just wouldn't buy it.
Well, that's so interesting because, so in 2007, the House passes the Matthew Shepard Act. Matthew Shepard is killed in 98 in a hate crime. This is the first time that the House brings a gay rights bill to the floor for a vote ever. This book reminded me in so many ways, because I think I read them back to back, more or less, for a previous episode, Angus Thongs and Full Frontal Snogging.
That's a name I haven't heard in a long, long
Whew.
time.
But there's something about that, and that deals more explicitly with lesbianism. There is a conversation around that. But there is this mentality of like, nobody knew that you could be attracted to more than one gender. It's like, it just simply didn't occur to you, at least in terms of like the pop culture you sense, the
A
collective.
lot of people still don't know. A
A
lot
lot of
of
people
people
still
have
don't
misremembered
know.
all that.
Yes, I didn't hear the word bisexual until 2013, and it blew my mind. I couldn't think about it for 2 years. I was just so fascinated by it. I was like 2 years before I could ever say maybe that's me. But I'm glad that you brought up the intensity of Rose in so many things, which I think always works very well for teens because that's what being a
Great.
teenager feels like. But Rose, to say she will die for Lyssa, first off, accurate. Second of all, feels insufficient to describe their bond, or at least how she feels about Lyssa.
And even the only time, so Lyssa begins to have what's probably, the second favorite fanfic kind of trope of like, pretty popular Galinda type female falling in love with the dark and brooding, forget like a school shooter type of guy. It's giving Heathers a little bit in that way, but
Oh, a
she does
little
a
bit. He
little
is
bit.
definitely, I read it as like very much brooding, I think more, which is this character Christian, which I read as like a very angel kind of prototype from
Yes,
Buffy.
100%. Like the
But
dark angel,
yes.
kind of vibe. But and I'm and I'm sure the internet went nuts for that at the time. I had parents that monitored mine, but I wasn't there, but I'm sure it was a time.
Well, also, this book comes out the year that Tumblr comes out.
Perfect timing. That's kismet.
Perfect timing. Yeah.
But it's interesting because how like she's so jealous and weirded out at first, kind of rightfully so by their relationship. Like, he's from an ashamed family. The parents turned Strigoi, which is like they intentionally turned into the evil vampires, and that just completely disgraced the rest of the family, including him. So every show, it's kind of like nobody really blames him, but also nobody really wants to like be around him either. And Rose is so against their relationship from the get. At first, kind of like, oh, I'm scared for you. But then once she has sufficient enough evidence to know, like, okay, this guy's like probably fine, she's still not okay with it until he quite literally almost dies for her. Then she's like, okay, it's fine. He'll do. And
That,
that's
yeah.
wild.
Rose is, and like, I was probably, if I had the supernatural abilities that Rose had, I probably would have been as bad of a friend as Rose is, because I get it. But Rose, again, can see through Lyssa's thoughts. And sometime at the beginning, it's random. She learns to kind of control it. She is able to see into Lyssa's like private meetings with this guy who becomes her crush. And ultimately, Rose corners this guy and is like telling him all of these lies about Lyssa doesn't like you and doesn't want to be with you, and completely torpedoes that relationship. That is the thing like that I'm the most horrified by, is like, how
Yeah, it's
could
actually
Lyssa ever
terrible.
forgive that? Yeah.
Yeah, they really kind of breeze by it. They really do. And granted, like, do they have much bigger things going on by the end? 100%. Like, it's one of those, it's kind of like the end of Wicked in the sense where it's just like, oh, like, I forgive you for everything. It's like, oh, well, if the stakes weren't higher, maybe that wouldn't be the case. But it's kind of like one of those where it's like, okay, I feel like they all just sort of moved on after the neck fire happened. But yeah, no, Mead does a very good job of tapping into those very realistic YA relationships and tendencies to just be a shit friend sometimes for really petty reasons of being jealous, of being like, I want my best friend and I don't want to share her. Maybe for a deeper reason, perhaps, that exists below the subconscious, and maybe not. But yeah, I think that was also like such a reason that this book held such a special place in my heart, was it's like, oh, like I'm seeing myself in the mistakes that Rose makes. I see myself in I see the girl that I want to be in Rose. Like, she's tough. Like, she falls down, she gets back up again. She'll do anything for the people around her. She's intense. She's not afraid to say what she thinks. She's not afraid to get in trouble. And it's she was like the avatar for me. She was the who I more so wanted to see myself in and emulate at that age for sure.
Yeah, if I had read this at the time, 100%. And I like Buffy was such a touchstone for me, but Buffy always has the weight of the whole world on her shoulders, where Rose just has the weight of Lyssa.
One person who
Exactly.
one person who has the weight on her shoulders, like.
Yes. But I think Buffy makes mistakes where Rose is messy in a way that Buffy kind of doesn't have. Like Buffy, not from a like a writerly perspective, but Buffy as like a real individual does not have the sort of room to have grace, to be messy and make mistakes. And so it was like a really I'm sure there were characters similar to Rose out there, but I certainly was not getting them. And it feels kind of, again, like rare for 2007 to have a girl this messy.
A girl that's messy that also does whatever she kind of still sort of control her own destiny and control the narrative. I mean, you even think about the way that, to be clear, she's still a child, but the way that she goes after Dimitri in the sense of like, I want this, I'm going to pursue this man in a way that like Bella doesn't necessarily do with Edward. Bella's fine to take the back seat. She's fine to be submissive to Edward, which, you know, in a way, and of course there's so much discourse around like, you know, he's still technically like what, 100 years old? Is that not worse in some ways? But Rose is the type that's like, no, like I want to be the dominant one in so many ways. And of course, like, you know, she's insecure in very authentic ways that teenage girls are insecure, you know, when she feels the perceived rejection and when she feels like, oh, like, you know, are people looking at me? Does he not like me? And of course, like she can't think beyond the teenager mindset of like, it's not that he doesn't like you. It's the, but I remember, you know, I would have thought the same way. Like, I mean, you know, I had crushes on my teachers when I was 17, and of course, you think like, oh, I'm a grown up. No, you're not. You know, oh my God, it's just so quintessentially adolescent in that way.
Yeah, and it's especially heightened because Rose ran away with Lyssa, and Rose was, I mean, in all the ways that we've discussed, was the caretaker. So Rose has been in that kind of adult role. She's been taking care of herself and someone else. So I think it's even then, you know, the great applicable works are the ones that take the not mundane, but the very realistic and heighten them into a way that sort of lets us act out
Yeah.
the internal things. But there's the headmaster and a handful of teachers that are very minor characters, but there are no parents really in this book. A lot of them are dead
Yeah.
or
It's the dead
absent.
parent. It's the inspired by Disney of the dead parent trope, of the absentee parent trope. Again, you have to think like not too deeply into some of the lore. I think the primary one being like, okay, if the Dampirs are less powerful, why are they guarding the more powerful people? It's so weird. Like they use them as like sacrifices in a way. And that's also kind of an interesting, especially in the first one, like the political undertones that she's infusing the novel with, which this is also still during the time, at least when I read them, it was like still Obama's America, very very different vibe. But you know, the stirrings of like a political revolution that become that those move more to the forefront later on. But it's like, you know, establishing this world of what does it mean to sacrifice yourself? What does it mean to have to give your life to somebody else, to lose a part of lose who you are? And I think that's a very interesting kind of almost like sense of dread lurking underneath the surface there that I think I also definitely subconsciously pulled from of like there's this sense of dread that I feel like Rose has that she's going to lose who she is once she becomes a guardian. Like she even just like the little but they wouldn't feel a little they certainly don't feel a little when you're a teenager, which is like, oh, like I can't wear my hair the way I want. I can't dress the way I want. I have, you know, I can't have a relationship with the person that I want to be with, qualms and all with that. And it's interesting in the sense because it's like it almost feels like a placeholder in that book for like, you know, how a lot of girls feel. I think more girls feel this way than what they care to admit. I mean, I certainly did, of like, there's that sense of dread of when you get married or when you become a woman and you're no longer a girl. And what does giving up that agency mean in society? Like, there is that symbolic dread of becoming, like, transforming from a girl to a woman, and then that meaning that you lose something in yourself, which is, I really don't know, other books that I was reading at the time that really kind of touched on that in such a straightforward way.
Yeah, especially because with, I mean, we're justifiably coming back to Twilight a lot. I mean, they're, of course we are, but I think Bella so eagerly wants to leave all of that behind. She so badly wants to become a vampire. Where what's interesting also is that Rose is not, you know, seeking that. Her identity is not going to be subsumed by who she dates. It is going to be in this person that she does adore, and that she, you know, it is such a rich relationship, and yet she is sort of having to, throughout the novel, sort of mute or limit or sort of chop off parts of herself in order to kind of play the political game that Lyssa has to play. And it is so weird, this dynamic between the Dampiers and the Morai, in that you are born into subservience to the point where when the vampire queen comes to the academy, the Dampier kids have to sit in the back.
Like, what's going on there? Like, let's unpack that.
Yes, and it's such a toss-away line, and it is so like this is how it's always been. There is even, and it sounded like you said this plays out more in later books, which is really exciting because there's little seeds laid of like maybe it's Christian who says this to Lyssa, but like you are just toeing the party line that you have been told forever. There's a moment where Rose sort of says like new things are come, the outside ever-changing world is coming into the academy, and that's really freaking some people out, which is so classic. I mean, this is published the year that Obama announces his candidacy. This is the year that the iPhone comes out. There's so much change happening, and that it's largely through the young people, I think, as it always is.
It is, and this is also. This book was written pre-iPhone. This book was written during a time where this is not even a little bit horrifying to think about, a time that no one will ever know again. Even just like these minor scenes of like, teenagers going and they're making mistakes and they're drinking and they're doing God knows what with God knows who. And there's still a sense of privacy that they're enshrouded in that does not exist anymore. Like, this world of privacy and that exists in this book is gone forever.
Yeah,
That
because
specific.
girls can behave badly. You know, they can sleep with a guy or they can do X, Y, and Z, but there aren't pictures. You know, there's not smartphones going around. It's.
It's just rumors. It's the duplicity of the person you're choosing to do that with, the duplicity of your friends, or how just like malicious and cruel people can be, and how just petty gossip that people engage in for whatever reason. But there's not this very new, sinister technological aspect to it.
Yeah, the only really tech presence I can remember is I think every dorm room gets a computer.
Yeah, she's like, oh, my computer. And I'm like, oh my gosh.
Exactly. And it was like, well, they give every student a computer. And that, I was like, whoa, we're rich here. Gosh. I think you mentioned this earlier that your high school looked like Hogwarts. I love like a really insular setting for narratives, but I love that it's like Hogwarts, but we're horny and we're allowed to be horny. Yeah.
Oh, that. And but it's so interesting, like, the more that you and I are delving into this, like, it's weirdly, this book was progressive in many ways for the time. It's certainly not by today's
100%.
standards, but when you think about it at the time, like, it was edgy, but I wouldn't say it was edgy for the sake of being edgy. I think she was really trying to say something and explore something with all these themes and these characters, even though, like, and I don't know, intentional or not, like, there's something that made me a little wistful, I suppose, when revisiting it. It's just, and that is, like, what's disappointing to me a little with, like, the Dimitri narrative is, like, every man in Rose's life sexualizes her. Even like Victor Dashoff, like makes comments about her appearance. Like, she I don't think she evades it with any male character. And it's so It's a reality, and that's certainly not a part of the book that you can be like, oh, this is made up. This is just, this only exists in a far off fantasy land. This, like, the misogyny in the books is very real. And I don't, especially because just due to the time that it was written, I don't know that that was infused to make a commentary. Perhaps it was. It's hard to say, having lived through, the early aughts. It's just like, oh, no, it kind of just was that sexist. But reading it as a 29-year-old woman looking back, there's like a part of me that like wants to protect this girl, and just like help her be like, no, he doesn't like you. He's just,
That's so true. And there's even in, I think early on in setting up the world, they say that like Rose is kind of curvy. And the Dampiers are all like stick thin. And there's even a line that's like, Moroi are skinny in a way that humans want to be, but never can be. And I wasn't really thinking about that too hard until I was like flipping through my notes earlier today, where it's like, is Mead saying that beauty standards are impossible to attain? Like, I don't know if that's on purpose in there.
That's so hard to say. Like, truly, with that time period, it is so hard to say, especially because I lived through it. It did irreparable damage on me because it's like how people will be like, oh, well, like, well, The Devil Wears Prada was just a commentary on the fashion industry. So it shouldn't have. That's really what little girls were taking from it at the time. Like, let's be real. I don't know how attuned my satire filter was at the time. So I was definitely taking in all of that. But it's also, the flip side of that is like still like, Rose is like, oh, I'm cur the more I, yeah, there are skinny in ways that humans want to be but never can be. It's like, ooh, and like, I'm curvy and I have big boobs and I have a big butt. And it's like, it's still like, let's remember who was getting famous around this time, who popularized that body type, then that, kind of became the new sort of desirable. But it's like, and either Rose is still, attractive in a way that's not attainable for Mora.
Absolutely.
And she says, yeah, well, I th yeah, and I think in the same breath, she says something along the lines of like, yeah, like, Mora girls like kind of secretly want to look like the Dampier girls, but it's like wrong or dirty or taboo. And there's potentially some deeper, maybe coded cultural or maybe even racial undertones there perhaps, but
Now that I think about it.
yeah, because I'm like, that's a little too on the nose. Especially too because they hype, they harp on so much like how pale the Morai are. Like they're like, they're, you've heard pale, they're even paler. Like
Or
they're
even
not,
paler.
yeah, they're even paler. They're, this is the French aristocracy just putting powder on their face, basically. It's just very that. And what's interesting, in the new the Peacock series, which I have not watched, but I've seen, it looks bad. I don't know how any of those, it's just, it's cut and it's edited like such a serious drama. And I'm like,
Oof. You have to have fun with it.
and I will say, justice for the 2014 movie in that regard. Is it good? No. Is it a blast? Absolutely. It's an unapologetic blast, and the cast is great. It's a fun movie. It knows what it is. It really doesn't seem like this new series really understood what it was, but all the characters don't look how they're in the book. And how intentional was that in terms of the theme, like of appearance that they're going for? Who's to say? I wasn't in the casting room, but I think it's certainly worth noting.
Wow, because I am thinking, I've seen the poster at least, and Rose is played by either a black or a mixed race woman. And what this is reminding me of is recently I read Artemis Fowl for this show. And in that they have a similar thing of like there's one family that is like high status, and then there's another family that has been that every generation is meant to serve the other one and protect and like be a butler. And in the book, they're both white. In the movie that they made in 2020, the bodyguard is black. And then you have this element of a whole line of families who are born to be subservient to the other, and one is white and one is black. And then you have that transposed onto this 2022 Peacock series.
Yeah, it doesn't feel accidental. I mean, especially coming off the heels of 2020, it certainly can't be. I think I'd have to really watch the series and see how deeply they delve into those themes. It does appear just from the marketing that they do kind of amp up the political storylines a little bit more. Perhaps if it was renewed, like that would have maybe been more of the nucleus of the story. But yeah, it's hard to say without watching, but it's something definitely worth noting.
Yeah, especially then if you lean into sort of like a liberation narrative, that could be interesting, but you do first have to set up and like justify all these choices that you make on the surface. Interesting. Also, in talking about Angus Thongs and full frontal snoggings, the scene in which Dimitri at the very end says, "I'm too old for you, we can't do this," is almost identical to a page in Angus Thongs that is,
Really?
"I'm too old for you and we can't do this." It is, I texted it to Britt Miggs, who was our guest for that episode, and she was like, "Holy shit." But another thing I really liked in both of those is that, and especially with Vampire Academy, because you have making out, you have sex and all of this stuff, even though Rose does not actually have sex, the moments that are like the most erotic and like that get you gasping are like, "And then he touched my hair," or like, "He sat next to me and our knees touched." That feels so high school, and those are the ones that
It's
I
so high.
loved it.
To accidentally paraphrase Taylor Swift, it's so high school in that way.
I loved
It
it.
really is. And honestly, it's so Catholic school too,
Oh, say more,
for
please.
sure. Especially like with how, I mean, just the harping on virginity for sure, and like from the get, you know, that that's like a part of it. I'm like, oh, this is Chekhov's virginity. It's mentioned in the first act. It's gonna have to get lost later, right? Like,
I should write that down.
yeah, I'm like, oh, well, there's that. So
She does not lose her virginity by the end, but she comes pretty damn close. She's fully nude.
but she's ready, but she
She.
says I'm ready too. So it's, and they give you the fake out, and it does, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I believe she does lose her virginity to Dimitri later. I know that there's other, and let me tell you, I did not realize how thick the cobwebs in my brain were over this book until dusting it off for this. I was like, holy moly, there's a lot that does not age well in this. She ends up with Dimitri, like in the long term, her and Dimitri end up getting married, and I don't remember like really what ends up happening past that, but like it's the as is, you know, with how fan service tends to go, you know, the original couples end up together, like Lyssa and Christian end up together, and Dimitri and Rose end up together, and then
Yeah, there's not a whole ton of information about Rochelle Mead out there, but I was on her Facebook page, which hasn't been updated in like 7, 8 years, but she is like resharing fan artwork, and that's just cute. It's
I
just
love that.
nice.
No, I love that. I really do. That's so funny that she's kind of elusive in that.
She has a Twitter. I don't think so she used it in like 2020 once to say casting has been announced for the Peacock series. And then before that, the next post down was from 2017 saying the book series turns 10 this year. And that's how often she goes. Doesn't have an Instagram. Very interesting.
Yeah, so interesting. Especially just based off of, you know, the tidbits that you shared. I mean, I'm fascinated by whatever's going on in her brain. I'm fascinated by the way that all of those varied gears all turn at the same time. I find
I
that really.
really like don't have any information about her pre-college other than she grew up in Michigan and she went to college in Michigan and now she lives in a Seattle suburb. That's all I've got.
Oh my gosh, the Seattle suburbs and vampires again. Has to be true.
Although this book takes place in Montana.
That is correct. That is correct.
I don't know what that could mean.
There have to be people who exist that are like Swifties, but for vampire academies that can use their sleuthing skills to figure that one out. So
Certainly, please.
honestly, the main thing I'm hoping from this, I mean, A, it was great to chat with you, but also it's like I've just been dying to talk about this book in general. I was able to find one out of my friends who had read this book a long time ago. I'm like, I don't know anyone else who was obsessed with this book the way I was. So I'm hoping people like come out of the woodwork with this, because I'm like, can't be me. They made a movie of the series. It can't just be me.
It can't just be you. I immediately, as soon as I finished this, borrowed the second book from the library.
I'm fully gonna reread these. Like, I got to the end. I'm
Exactly.
like, oh, this book did not age well. All right,
On
time
to
for
the
book
next
two.
one.
Let's go.
I
Give me
need
more.
it. Yes. It has like such niche elements that I love. Like, it does fit neatly into dark academia. Can't deny it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Can't deny it. It has one of my favorite things, which is there's an academic mystery we have to learn on top of our classes, and like going into the library and search. She was in the
Oh,
index at one point. I
beautiful.
loved it. Did you ever read Shadow and Bone?
I have heard wonderful things about Shadow and Bone. I have not read it, but yet I am also a slut for Dark Academia. So if that's a bump on the list that I gotta make,
A little
let me know.
bit. I mean, there's like a interlude in the first book where they're in a school. I got my gallbladder removed in 2021, and in the haze of like the week of recovery, I am not necessarily a fast reader. Through this podcast, I've gotten much faster. I read all three books in maybe 3 days. I watched the first season of the Netflix show. It was like the thing that clicked. And there's the elements of Saint Vladimir and his guardian, shadow kissed Anna. Love that. And like looking through the books of saints all reminded me so much of certain elements of Shadow and Bone. And what's interesting about that is it's like three series, and I think maybe the author has like some problematic takes recently. I
Don't
probably
they
can.
all, unfortunately?
Yeah. So those are that is an interesting situation where like each of these intersecting series has like a very different kind of feel. Like one of them is very like heist-like and fun.
Yeah. And this one also, I mean, we didn't even get to touch on this, I know, as much as we both wanted to, but just like the mental health
Oh
aspect
my God, we
of the
must.
book. Yeah, we
Yeah.
must. Because I mean, that was certainly something that as a teenager starting to try and understand, my mental health journey and a long journey that is not complete, this book definitely made me feel seen in a way that truly no other book at the time did. Because I feel like, it's. And those plot lines are written in such an early 2000s way, but also slightly in their defense, that was about the peak of the understanding we had at the time.
Yeah. And even reading it now as a 28-year-old still dealing with my mental health, and I started dealing with it when I was, 13, even now those pieces made me feel seen. And
Yes.
what is interesting is that it is obviously it is through Rose's perspective and Lyssa is the one dealing with depression. But again, we have this sort of really fun narrative device where we are able to go into Lyssa's head. Lyssa is dealing with self-harm, and I think like it is the best description of self-harm that I have read in that she is not trying to kill herself. There is something that needs to come out and
This
be
is the release.
released. That was astonishing to see that written with such clarity. And again, in 2007. And on top of that, there are sections where Rose has to figure out, even though I thought keeping this secret was the right thing for her, actually, the right thing to do was to tell a trusted adult. I even wrote it down. Hiding her cutting did nothing to protect her. It is very explicit in, like, if your friend is cutting herself, tell a trusted adult.
Yes, it becomes after school special in that way, but not in a bad way because
Absolutely.
realistically, the Venn diagram of young adults reading vampire content like this and young adults who are struggling with mental illness is probably a circle.
Yes, yes.
I think kudos to Mead for, and especially given that she was a teacher, it makes a lot of sense. Kudos to her for writing these very relatable dynamics and bonds and relationships and characters that especially young girls who maybe struggling with self-harm can see themselves in, and especially too like for their friends who you don't know when you're that age. And I would agree with you. It does get a little borderline breaking the fourth wall in that way, but for the best, really.
Yeah, I think like when you're 12, 15, whatever, having like a really clear billboard of that, again, like toeing the line of breaking the fourth wall is what you probably need from that. And I also liked that the trusted adult, and again, it's getting freaky with the age gap,
For sure.
the
We are
trusted
about it,
adult
yeah.
she goes to is Dimitri, who's only 7 years older. He's 24. But I liked that the trusted adult doesn't have to be mom, dad,
Yeah.
principal. I think that was also a very nice touch.
But
Absolutely.
also, the way that it touches on the fears that teenagers have. Oh, they're gonna take me away. I'm gonna get in trouble. Everyone's gonna talk about me. Everyone's gonna make fun of me. Like those kinds of things. They deal with it quietly. They deal with it effectively. I mean, that granted, they kind of, put her on pills and send her on her merry way. But also at the time, that's about the best you're gonna get.
Yeah.
But it's at the time, you know, like that's the best course of action for that kind of thing. And I do think Mead writes with a lot of compassion, you know, for teenagers who might be struggling with that. And it's the message that the takeaway is essentially like, hey, you know, like I see you. You're not a freak. There's not something wrong with you. You know, there's an incorrect, but you know, I see your line of thinking, and you're trying to deal with this hurt, and that to want to release that hurt isn't wrong, but this also isn't the way. And there's another way, and there's a safer way, there's a better way, and there's people that love you that will help you. And I think there is something really beautiful about that, especially given the fact that Rose doesn't understand, and she's very upfront about the fact that she doesn't. She's like, I don't get this. I don't understand these pills. I don't understand how they work. I always kind of thought all of this talk about mental health was nonsense. But if that's what my best friend needs, that's what my best friend needs. And I'm like, you know what? Like, you don't need somebody who always necessarily 100% understands, but you need somebody who's going to stand by you and do the right thing.
Absolutely. I was so afraid of taking medication for my depression that I didn't until I was halfway through college. And yet there is a line, again, she doesn't really understand it, but it's like they're pills just like any other pills, and they're made to help a problem, and they make it so that it's easier for her to live her life. And hell yeah. And it, like you said, it's nice that she doesn't have to have all of the answers. It's that she has all of the right intentions. I was so blown away with that whole narrative. And I think this, like, obviously it's from 2007. Obviously it's a young adult novel with a lot of parts that don't age well. I was very, very impressed by this book. In talking about, like, would you recommend this today? For a lot of these books, it's like, yes, with a lot of footnotes. And I think,
I think
same
that's fair.
here, same here. And yet some really, really great gems within it. Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, it's even though I certainly many a plethora of cringy moments, there were some very sincere ones. There were some really good beats in it that made me feel something again, made me feel like a teenager again. And I was like, oh yeah, like, you know, with all the footnotes, with all of the caveats. There's a reason they tried to reboot it in 2022. At its core, there's something still in it that people see themselves in.
Absolutely. It is really, really impressive. It speaks so well to a person. I mean, the pacing is great. It was an ebook, it was on my phone. I was always ready to come back and read it. Those final sequences that start with the really hot and heavy, sexy stuff, and then Lissa is kidnapped, and then she's in a trunk, and then there's wolves, and it's all really good, and you're
Zero to
eager.
100 so quickly. I mean, it's a fantastic third act
Yes.
ending, I think, and they tie it up neatly enough that it could have been one book, it could have been a standalone novel, but also she lays the groundwork for a lot of, I mean, there were many sequels, and I think there was also another, like, a spin-off series in
Yeah. I
that
know
as
this series is six books,
well.
and
This is
she's.
six, but I think there was, like, a Bloodlines,
Yeah.
like a
Yes.
spin-off.
Yes. There is definitely a series called Bloodlines. But in, like, she hasn't published a book in a while. But in the 11 years that she was publishing, if I get this right, 35 books in 11 years.
Good for her. She's making us all look bad.
Oh, girly. What was interesting is that, like, in a counterpoint to a very classical structure, there is no, like, denial of the call for Rose. She, like, doesn't want to go back to school, but she is so 100% in her destiny already. Yeah.
Yeah, like there's certainly moments of doubt, but yeah, you're right. There's not sort of that. I would say the closest thing to sort of like the Dark Night of the Soul is just her dealing with coming to terms with the fact that her actions have consequences and they can have severe consequences, and those consequences impact Lissa, which that's about to be her job. You know, like there's something that like actually made me laugh out loud is the part where like Lissa's like, but you're the irresponsible one and I'm the responsible one. It's like, yeah, well, like this girl's about to be taking care of you. She can't be irresponsible. You know, like
Exactly.
that's terrifying to think about, actually. But
Yeah.
that's interesting. And so I think, like, back to the slut shaming, you know, there's a rumor that's circulated out of malice that, you know, Rose let Morai boys drink her blood, which is like a
The highest taboo,
the
yeah.
highest taboo, like a kinky thing that Morai men do to dampier women. So that just like completely tarnishes her reputation. But you know, something I think to that point, she only really comes back from that initially because Lissa uses like hypnosis essentially on many people, and she's like, no, it's not a big deal. And they're all like, oh, you're right, it's not a big deal. And I think that I do think that's a very interesting commentary on just how impressionable people are, and how like how quickly patriarchy, misogyny takes and spreads, and how much it takes, like a just how powerful it is, and like what it's up against. And he's like, do we really need something like otherworldly powers to reverse the damage that patriarchy does? That's a little depressing.
And in addition to that, Lyssa has this power to, it's called compulsion. What is interesting in that, and talking about like being from these important families, Mead talks so much about like the political movings, obviously, of this great the adults, but also the political workings of the kids, and how you want to be close to power, and how Lyssa and Rose sort of separate from each other because of their sort of perceived social status, the kind of like school antagonist. A big part of her storyline becomes like that her family are cleaners for like the high up vampires. There's so much there in that status, and she's like, no, they're like advisors, and they're not cleaning toilets. And it's that's again like there are so many little moments that have so much to sort of spark thought and conversation.
Agreed, definitely. I feel so much more grounded and confident in my choice of book after this conversation. I'm glad that we found the good, the bad, and the ugly of the Vampire Academy.
Certainly. And we both have said we're this is not the last of the Vampire Academy for each of us
No,
in
I can't believe I said that out loud, actually. I was gonna keep that a secret, but like, no, I'm fully about to. On record, I will admit, I'm about to go read the second one.
Me too. So the final question, would you consider this required reading?
Required, perhaps not supplemental, maybe bonus. Maybe you finish the bare bones of the curriculum that give you the wherewithal to understand the footnotes that come along with Vampire Academy. Go for it, read it. And if you're a if you're a vampire freak, yeah, it's required reading. What are you doing? Actually, if you're a vampire nerd and you haven't read this book, you should be embarrassed. Normies can. That's fine, but no, I feel like you can't call yourself a vampire fan if you haven't read this personally.
No. This, I think, is like not, I don't want to say a beach read, but this is like some high quality, semi-high quality summer reading, certainly.
I would agree. Oh, definitely big summer reading vibes, but like go read it at like somewhere where you can see some ruins, perhaps, or when there's a crisp, right when the precipice one, the crisp fall chill in the air.
At a rainy coffee shop in Seattle in a misty hills of Ireland, I don't know.
Cliffs of Moher for sure. You know, what everybody reading on the Cliffs of Moher? Yeah, look it out. Yeah.
We've done Wuthering Heights. We've covered it on the podcast, and when you need not a palate cleanser, but something a little fun.
Agreed.
Well, is there anything you'd like to plug? Any place that you would like to be found?
Oh, if you would like to read more of my opinions on various cinema books, sometimes other types of things, follow me on Instagram at Liz Cuesta. I'm also on the artist formerly known as Twitter as that as well. I have some things coming up that I can't quite drop yet, but at some point I can once my paperwork allows me to do so. But yeah, I think that's my main thing for now. If you are New York City based, I am co-hosting with Laura Ornella a surreal film festival called Surreal World that'll be at Second City in Greenpoint at on January 25th. Would love to see you all there if you live in the Big Apple. So.
Amazing. Well, I still need to figure out a proper way to end this, but thank you so much. I'll see you at Vampire Academy.
Yes, absolutely. Keep in touch, unless we develop a psychic bond or something, but
Well,
you
I'll end the recording there.
know. All right.